and Rick Prokopian.
Yeah.
Would you give a summary?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 189 allows the Department of Human Services to purchase or distribute vaccines for minors that contain trace amounts of thimerosal when no other vaccine for same purpose is commercially available in a form that does not cause undue burden on the immunization providers. Brief piece of background, thimerosal is a mercury-containing organic compound. Since the 1930s, it's been used as a preservative in a number of drug products, including vaccines, to help prevent contamination. Over the past several years, because of increasing awareness of potential for even low levels of thimerosal being toxic, and because it's being used in increased number of vaccines, including those for infant immunizations, there's been concerns about using these vaccines, and they've been a lot of them taken off the market. Thimerosal has been removed from reduced and trace amounts in all vaccines routinely recommended for children 6 years of age and younger, with the exception of inactivated influenza vaccine. Vaccines with trace amounts of thimerosal contain 1 microgram or less of mercury per dose. In 2001, Oregon passed a current statute that prohibits purchase or distribution of pediatric vaccines necessary for school entry immunization requirements, except for circumstances when it is found that trace amounts no other vaccines for the same purpose commercially available in a form that does not contain thimerosal. That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Prokopian. Let's call Lorraine Duncan and Paul Cieslak from the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, while they're getting set up, something I always tried to do when I chaired the House Human Service Committee was at some point during the session make sure that Katie King had to testify on a bill, so you might want to consider that. So.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Duncan, Department of Human Services Immunization Program Manager. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm here to support Senate Bill 189, which is asking for flexibility in regard to purchasing pediatric vaccines with thimerosal. The current statute and the policy of the Department of Human Services is not to buy pediatric vaccines with thimerosal. The problem that we've had over the last 4 years is right after this legislation passed, there was a new recommendation introduced by the Center for Disease Control recommending that children get influenza vaccine. And instead of having the influenza vaccine come in a formulation that was usable for all children and without thimerosal, it came in multiple formulations, some with thimerosal, some without thimerosal, and some with non-compliant ocean needles. So what this presented was a complication in that in order to comply with the statute, the immunization program had to provide 3 different formulations of pediatric influenza vaccine to every pediatrician that wanted to have the vaccine. This caused a lot of administrative difficulty for some physicians. Some physicians handled it very well, and some felt it was much too complicated. I think most of you know that the schedule for immunizations is already very complicated. We have more than 20 different vaccines and multiple indications of who can and cannot have vaccines. Some have 15 or 20 footnotes about who can have it and who can't. So adding 3 additional formulations for flu vaccine was considered to be an administrative burden for providers. So what we're asking for you to consider is the possibility of allowing us, when an exception like this occurs, to take it to our Immunization Policy Advisory Committee, and if they approve that, then adopt it into administrative rule. What's happening with immunizations is that we get many new vaccines licensed every year with multiple formulations, and when the details are in statute, it's very difficult to change those. So we're asking for a little bit of flexibility by doing it through administrative rule after the Immunization Policy Advisory Team has approved that. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Dr. Cieslak is here to talk a little bit more about thimerosal. And I brought some additional testimony, which I shared with a committee assistant from another pediatrician. Thank you.
Go ahead, Dr. Cieslak. Thank you. Lorraine.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Paul Cieslak. I manage the Communicable Disease Program for the State of Oregon, and I am the Medical Director for the Immunization Program as well. I'm here to testify as well in support of Senate Bill 189 and to offer my perspectives on the issue of thimerosal. Thimerosal became of concern back in 1999 when somebody added up the number of doses of thimerosal-containing vaccine that a child could receive by the age of 6 months and said this may exceed EPA reference standards in some cases, depending on the weight of the child and how many of them contain thimerosal. And the Institute of Medicine convened an advisory panel and issued this report on thimerosal-containing vaccines in 2001, and they recommended that thimerosal be gotten out of the vaccines, as was already being done, and they said there were not enough data to conclude whether or not thimerosal had caused a problem. And the problem that was suspected was autism, because diagnoses of autism had been climbing throughout the 1990s, and somebody suspected that maybe this was due to thimerosal-containing vaccines. So this report was sort of inconclusive and called for more studies to be done. Since then, there have been six well-designed epidemiologic studies involving several countries, the United States, Denmark, Sweden, and millions of children analyzed in these databases that, especially in Sweden and Denmark, basically contain all the children born in the country and all of their medical diagnoses and all of their vaccines. And all six of these studies found no association between thimerosal and neurodevelopmental disorders like autism. For this reason, the report that came out last year by the Immunization Safety Review Committee of the Institute of Medicine was quite definitive, and they said the evidence favors rejection of the hypothesis that thimerosal in vaccines is associated with autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders. So basically, the issue from a scientific standpoint has been laid to rest. The thimerosal is out of almost all of the vaccines, and I would submit to you that if it came down to a choice between giving a child an influenza vaccine because there was no other vaccine available that contained thimerosal and not giving a child the influenza vaccine, that the data would say you're better off giving the vaccine, that the risk from thimerosal has basically not been found to be there, but there is a definite risk from influenza and some of the other vaccine preventable diseases, so go with the vaccine. And that's basically what I have to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Yes, thank you. Paul, they ruled out thimerosal. Did they come to any conclusions as to what could be causing the increase in autism?
No, they really didn't. There's a lot of suspicion that it's just increasing diagnoses of autism, that more physicians are aware that it's out there. And the increases were seen even in countries that stopped using thimerosal at all 10 and 15 years ago. They saw similar increases in autism rates. So we think it may be diagnostic changes. But the committee also recommended that, you know, we need more research into what is causing autism, but they said we should stop barking up this tree of thimerosal and channel the research into areas that are likely to be more productive.
Thank you.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Doctor, I guess I wasn't clear about we're using less vaccine with thimerosal now. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. In 1999, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, and the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended that thimerosal be gotten out of all the childhood vaccines. And that was essentially done, except for, you know, a couple of exceptions like influenza vaccine and multi-dose vials. So basically, the kids are getting almost none of these vaccines anymore that had thimerosal.
Okay, that follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
But is that in all of the influenza vaccines or part of the influenza vaccines? I'm still not sure how prevalent thimerosal is.
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, the thimerosal was really only contained in multi-dose vials. If you have a syringe that has one dose of vaccine in it, it doesn't need a preservative. But if you have a vial that has 10 doses and the docs and nurses are going in and out of it to get dose after dose after dose, those are the ones that required the preservative. So for the most part, we're going to these single-dose vaccine things, and so we're not using the multi-dose vials so much anymore.
Okay, thank you.
You had said that this year there is a syringe that's thimerosal-free, but OSHA did not approve it.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, in previous years, Chiron had produced a formulation that was thimerosal-free, but the drawback was it came in with non-OSHA-compliant needles. And we've had clarification from the Attorney General's office just in the last 2 weeks that made it very clear that the federal law takes precedent over the state statute in that we cannot buy any vaccine with non-OSHA-compliant needles. So if the only vaccine available is thimerosal-free, but it only comes in with non-OSHA-compliant needles, we can't buy it.
Okay.
Thank you. Specifically, influenza vaccine, is there a price difference between the single shot and the vials with 10 shots?
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, there's a small difference, a dollar, $2 difference. And it depends on the manufacturer, but they're, you know, $1.50
per shot. So, Madam Chair, so if we're looking at 1 million shots, mm-hmm. we're talking some real money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Stick around. We may call you back.
Okay.
I'd like to call to the podium Bernard Jekyll? The Jekyll? How do you say?
Bufell.
I should have known that. And Jim Lace, Dr. Jim Lace can come up too at the same time.
Oh, this is going to be a controversial one.
Go ahead.
Madam Chairperson Anderson and committee members and staff, I'm Bernard Bufell, pediatrician in private practice in Tigard, Oregon. I'm here just to briefly speak on the impact of the requirement to have individual doses and syringes on an office practice. Mine's a solo practice. It's even more marked when it's in a large clinic. The three different types of vaccines that were alluded to, one is a 5 or 10 dose, depending on the age of the child, multi-dose vial. Then there's syringes that are aimed at the 6 month to less than 3 year population, and another syringe that is aimed at the 3 and older. A vial of the 10 cc of the 5 cc is this big. A box of syringes is this big. And if you're looking at below the age of 3, where it's half the dose, it takes 2 boxes to be equivalent to 1 vial. So we're looking at almost 20 times the refrigerator space, and we're already storing many, many vaccines. It would almost mean that for the 3 months of the year that you use it, you'd have to have a separate refrigerator. And there's no advantage to those thimerosal-free vaccines to the child. And as it was alluded to with the prior speaker, it's significantly more expensive, which is one of the reasons I don't buy it in my practice. Additionally, last week I attended a seminar in Hillsboro on medication errors. And this is one that's rife for the possibility if you're in a busy clinic, because the two syringes for the different doses look very, very similar. And it would be easy for a nurse or medical assistant to pull the wrong one. And for the older child, that would mean getting a half a dose of what they should have gotten, and therefore probably not the immunity that they need. For the younger child, one of the reasons for the lower dose is because with a higher one, they have more side effects of fever and soreness. So you would have mothers who would get to experience a fussier child because of our error. We always try and minimize vaccine errors, but when it's possible not to make that error, we should do whatever is possible to avoid trying to make it. And then, again, looking at the federal budgets and the state budgets, which are under a significant crunch with regards to money, paying more for vaccine when there's a cheaper and safe alternative does not seem to make sense. Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah. This last year, at the beginning of the flu season, when there was a shortage, was the shortage across the board? I mean, I mean, are these individual syringes more readily available than the bulk, or does that really matter?
I would think that they are probably less readily available because not as many people want them. So it would force the state to try and get the manufacturer to increase their production, which, if it's only related to one state, they might not do. The reason for the shortage was that a company that was supposed to make $55 million had to destroy it all.
Yeah, just follow, Madam Chair, but that did happen, you know, through no fault of anybody here. I mean, you know, it's the British. But but the fact is that, this isn't the first time we've had a shortage, and shortages can happen for whatever reason. I guess if we have regulations that limit access, that's also another issue that's relevant here.
Okay, you can stay put if you and Dr. Lace.
Hi, I'm Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician from Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. You have my written testimony in front of you. Just to review very quickly on these vaccines, it's a very complicated system. We have vaccines for children, which provide the vaccine through the state for the Oregon Health Plan children and for special groups of children that fall within the rules. Then we have our commercial vaccine supply, which is, with the vaccines. We try in our office, we have 12 providers. In Salem, and so I guess we're a bigger group, but we try to meld the Vaccines for Children program with our private supply. This year we had almost a two-month delay on the flu vaccine, not through anybody's fault except, I think, the failure on the federal level for how they want to do vaccines, what their policy is about making available the flu vaccine, and whether or not they want to structure it differently and say, gosh, we're going to buy these vaccines, guarantee them. The pharmaceutical company some sort of a guarantee that they're going to get their money no matter what. Because typically, we get short. The flu vaccine is a great example. People were willing to pay hundreds of dollars for the flu vaccine. It should be a $15 vaccine. But what happens in our office is that then if there's a question that there's an actual shortage and we're faced with a rule that says you shall not use a thimerosal-containing vaccine in children less than 7, as it's currently written, as we understand it, then we're kind of violating existing statute by actually administering that vaccine. So in those situations where we don't have an alternative, we would support the concept of allowing the state, through the Vaccines Children Program or where we get the vaccines from, that alternative until the vaccine manufacturers figure out a way to use single-dose, multi-dose vials, single-dose vials that don't have any preservative in them. If not, then we need to say, gosh, the flu vaccine is going to be, that's the standard, and we need to make an administrative rule change that says that that's what it's going to be for the time being.
Any further discussion? I always like to err on the side of caution, and I was one of those that did react when I heard that there might have been an association between thimerosal and autism, and I think all of us probably felt that way. Science tends to be correct, and so we don't have it scheduled for a work session committee, but if there's no further discussion or at all or from the public, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 189 and bring it back at a later date for a work session. Thank you. Now I'd like to open an informational meeting on hepatitis C. Department of Human Services is who's here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Who's going first?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Department of Human Services. And it's my pleasure to be able to present to you today the results of a great deal of work by a large group of people that was done at the behest of the last legislative session. But what I'm going to do is say just a few brief words about hepatitis C and then tell you a little bit about the plan and how it was developed. And then I have with me someone who very much participated, and she will tell you all about what her experience was like in putting together this plan, and also give you some additional data and background information. Hepatitis C is a very, very large problem. It's something that we have been grappling with for many years. Hepatitis C is a viral disease that is transmitted primarily by contact with blood or other bodily fluids, but primarily blood, making the two major risk factors for infection intravenous drug use and also blood transfusions, at least in the past. By 1992, when the testing for hepatitis C became available, that essentially eliminated transfusion-associated cases of hepatitis C. They do occasionally occur, but very, very rarely now, because our blood supply is much, much safer in this regard than it was in the past. However, this is a chronic disease. Once people get infected with hepatitis C, a large number of them go on to develop chronic infection, meaning that their body can't get rid of the virus entirely. And this is dangerous in a number of ways. It affects the liver, and the two outcomes that we worry about the most are hepatocellular carcinoma, a kind of cancer of the liver, and also liver failure, and leading to often liver transplant. Obviously a very difficult thing for people. And of course, I'm not even beginning to talk about the many ways that hepatitis C infection affects people's daily lives of those who are infected. Now, we know that this is a very prevalent infection. About 2% of Americans are infected, and we estimate that that's about 64,000 people here in Oregon who are infected. We do have some treatment for the disease. It's not effective in every case. There's really three genotypes that we're primarily concerned with. Those are three different strains of the virus, if you will. Genotype 1 is far and away the most common here. However, it is the least responsive to treatment. About 30 to 40% of people who have a genotype 1 infection will clear the virus with appropriate treatment. Those with genotype 2 and 3 have a much higher rate, probably around 70 or 80% of response to treatment. And so this is it.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. What was the percent that you gave of the general population? 2 or 3?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Morse said it. 2%.
Okay. What's the prison population? Do we have any idea what the prison population in Oregon is, the percentage of people who have hepatitis C?
Yes. Chair Senator Morissette, I believe the figures are about 30% of the prison population is currently infected with hepatitis C.
Are you going to talk about any treatment that they get while they're there and they come out into the population and infect others and so on? That's
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Morissette, that's obviously a very important issue with regard to transmission of this disease, and that's part of, I'm really going to talk about the plan today, but perhaps my colleague here would like to comment on some of that as well.
Thank you.
So we do have this treatment, and actually the treatment has gotten better, more effective with time, but it is it's very expensive treatment, and also there are terrible side effects that are associated with this. So it's not a trivial thing to undertake. Of course, all of this means that really the best thing to do is to prevent these infections in the first place, and there's a lot of work that can be done around preventing hepatitis C infection as well. Well, because this is such a common infection and because the sequelae of it, the things that happen when you get infected can be so expensive and difficult to take care of, I think that was part of what motivated the legislature last session to pass House Bill 2451. I believe, Senator Cruz, you were quite supportive of this and others as well. This is a... This bill asked us to go ahead and put together a planning group around hepatitis C and pull together all of the stakeholders who are involved in this work around the state and come together and try to synthesize what would be an action plan, if you will, for the state. We were able to get some additional funding from the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists to support this work. And I do want to recognize Dr. Ann Thomas, who's sitting in the back row there from my office, who together with Dr. Ann Shindo put together, you know, they were really the staff for this group. If you open your plan, I believe you all have one, to page 12 and 13, you will see the list of folks who participated in putting together this plan, and it really is quite impressive. I mean, this covers the whole gamut. There's certainly folks from governmental public health at the state and county level. There's activists involved who made very important contributions. The pharmaceutical industry represented and involved with this. The naturopathic medicine community as well. We didn't just restrict this to the more traditional kinds of medicine, and also the Department of Corrections was also involved with this plan. The plan was developed really through five task groups that were topic related. The first was on education, second on prevention, third on management, fourth on surveillance and research, and then the fifth group on legislation, policy, and grant writing. And there are a number of strategies in the plan. I want to call your attention to one other item about this. Of course, in this budget climate, we're all very concerned about taking on new activities. You know, where are we going to get funding for this? Since this is such a common infection, even doing something that's relatively inexpensive because there are so many people involved, it becomes quite expensive and difficult to do. But if you look, for example, on page 21, after each of the action steps, there is either one asterisk or two asterisks. So one asterisk indicates something that can be done within our existing level of resources, and two is something that would require some additional resources being committed to this. So that's sort of the way that this plan is laid out. With that, I think I'm going to turn the microphone over, if I may, and we'll be happy to answer any questions as well, either now or in a few minutes.
My name is Lauren Sant, and I'm the Managing Ambassador of the Hepatitis C Caring Ambassadors Program. We're a national nonprofit organization based out of Oregon City, Oregon, and I am also a member of the group that worked on this plan. And I thank you, Madam Chair and Senator, for the opportunity to testify in front of the committee today. As you've heard, hepatitis C is the most common chronic viral disease in America today. It not only affects 3.8 to 4.5 million Americans, but approximately 64,000 Oregonians. And the CDC states that there's approximately 30,000 new cases happening annually today. It's the most common cause of chronic liver disease, and chronic liver disease is among the top 10 deaths in Americans from the ages of 25 to 74. Hepatitis C is an insidious, silent disease, and therefore the early quiescent nature of it makes it one of the most fundamental issues that we need to address as perilous public health threat. Significant numbers of people are unaware of their infection, and it's many years before the complications arise, and therefore unwittingly they are spreading it to their friends and family and other Oregonians without knowing why. And this is clearly why Surgeon General Koop described hepatitis C as one of the most significant, preventable, treatable public health problems facing our nation, and it's a graver threat than the AIDS crisis to the Americans. The consequences of hepatitis C for the state of Oregon are potentially dire in terms of fiscal and societal outcomes. Therefore, we fully support the Oregon Department of Human Services and their objectives as stated in the Hepatitis C Strategic Plan, namely to stop the spread of hepatitis C, to minimize the progression and the complications of chronic liver disease in people infected with hepatitis C in Oregon, and to promote comprehensive viral hepatitis C policy. Hepatitis C epidemic is threatening each day, as you can see from the statistics that I've put up in front of you. A landmark study was published by Dr. Wong in the American Journal of Public Health, and it lays forth the consequences of an unchecked epidemic in hepatitis C. But the good news is we have not yet squandered our opportunity for the ultimate outcome of this public health crisis. In the past decade, great advances have been made in treatment, and yes, treatment is difficult, but the bottom line is it is effective in more than 50% of the people that do try it. And it also halts the virus. These people are effectively cured of hepatitis C. We're at a critical juncture right now. Now's the time that we can successfully identify those people prior to the disease progressing to where there's nothing that they can do about it. Unlike HIV, hepatitis C is a short course of therapy. It's 6 months to 1 year, and if it works, then they're done and there's no more treatment necessary. It is certainly cost effective at $24,000 to $36,000 a year. It's much more cost effective than a $300,000 liver transplant. The bottom line is treating hepatitis C is effective, and the health services, we've put together this plan, and the plan is societally and fiscally responsibly, socially and fiscally responsibly. As Dr. Cohen pointed out, we knew that the Oregon is in a crisis, and we made sure that there were things that could be done without further monies and that could be done within the existing infrastructure, and we would really like to see those met. There is flexibility within this plan, and there's no reason that we shouldn't be able to implement a good portion of it. Hepatitis C is everyone's disease. There's many Americans. I'm one of the fortunate ones. I have two family members that have this disease, but they found out about the disease, and they now have an option to change the outcome of that disease for themselves and for our family. And I thank you for listening to us. I really support your efforts in working on this. I'm happy to answer your questions.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I worked with Phyllis Beck. You know Phyllis.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Phyllis is tireless
yes.
in this, but she concentrated her effort, I believe, on the prison, the corrections area. And as I remember the discussion before our committee, 4 years ago, there was very little testing. It had to be consensual testing, and there was very little treatment. And people are released into society with a treatable illness. Where are we on that particular issue in corrections? Are we making any headway?
It is my understanding that DOC is working very closely to address that issue, to get people tested, and to look at treatment.
What is the actual treatment? Is it a shot? Is it a pill? Is it a...
It's both. It's a pegylated interferon, which is the new standard of treatment, is a shot once a week. And then there's ribavirin, which is taken three times a week in a pill form.
And for a year?
6 months to a year. Genotype 2 or 3 are successfully treated within a six-month period. And genotype 1s need 1 year of treatment.
As you know, the revenue, we have a little revenue shortfall here in Salem, but boy, I certainly hope that DHS can at least start the, they don't need directive from us, do they, to start looking at these objectives, these action steps that don't require money. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a couple questions here. We also know we've made a couple stabs at this over the years to try to get something in place, and clearly the prison issue is one of them. Figuring that that's, you know, that's a high risk community and that's a good place to start, but we also know, don't we, that if you catch somebody in early stages, that they really don't need any treatment. All they have to do is change their lifestyle, and which was the direction we were wanting to go, was, you know, if you test positive, then you have a choice. And your choice is quit drinking, quit doing drugs, you know, eat right, exercise, all
quit
the stuff.
Quit smoking.
I don't remember that one. I don't remember that one specifically, but
sorry.
You know, I love this committee because you know, I think you're all in cahoots with my wife on this quit smoking thing. But that, but anyway, and like one of our efforts was, I mean, because we do know high risk communities, and one of our efforts was to attempt to get Hep C testing with HIV testing. So I guess my question is, these other approaches we've taken without having the time to read through your action items, how hard are we looking at doing the early stage intervention, let alone the, I mean, prevention is great, but intervention is needed too. And, you know, I mean, when you reach a certain state of the disease, you have no choice, you have to take the treatment. But the majority of the folks, I would say, that are infected can avoid that. So is that in here, and how is that in here?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, I think that we are working to try to address that within the constraints of the resources that we have. And one example I can give you is that Dr. Shindo, who, as I said, was one of the staff people that really put this together, has actually physically moved into our HIV prevention program. So she is working, you know, side by side, literally, with those folks to try to integrate as much as we can hepatitis C awareness and prevention. And I say prevention meaning that in the broadest sense of the word, not just preventing the first infection, but preventing the other problems that happen if you don't stop drinking and so forth if you are infected. So, you know, we are trying to do that as much as we can, and I hope that we are going to be making some headway in those areas.
Okay, Madam Chair, I guess part of the point is, and you're right, relatively inexpensive treatment as opposed to the end result without treatment, but doing a double screen on a blood sample is even cheaper than that. So,
how much is a treatment for one person?
Antiviral treatment?
Yeah, if it's 6 months. Or a year.
It's $24,000 to $36,000 a year, depending on
wow.
The state of Texas, where they have been able to implement testing and they have put the infrastructure in, they have gotten down the testing to $8.50. So as Senator Cruz rightly pointed out, for an $8.50 test, we can possibly prevent someone from going to an antiviral treatment at all. And he also pointed out rightly that the vast majority of people that have this disease will never need treatment if we can get them diagnosed prior to them progressing to stage 3 or 4 in their disease, in their liver disease.
How much is a transplant?
$300,000, and that does not include all the lifelong care after that, the drugs that they need to be on for the rest of their lives. Thanks. And they still have hepatitis C.
That's true. Senator Murtha.
Thank you. Now, the doctor, when I go in for my physical, there's a hepatitis A and hepatitis B. They do not test for hepatitis C.
Right.
Is that an insurance problem? Is that an insurance, would you call that a mandate, for instance, to the insurance company?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Morissette, you know, typically I can't speak to what your individual practitioner does, but it's certainly very common that somebody would go in and get a liver function test as part of a panel of tests that might get drawn. If you do have active hepatitis C infection, that should show up on that liver function test and then would bear some further investigation, including testing for hepatitis C. You know, one of the things Senator Cruz mentioned, the issue of stopping drinking, but there is also a vaccination issue as well, because if you have hepatitis C, you don't want to have your liver hit by another virus like hepatitis B or hepatitis A virus. So getting those folks vaccinated is also very important. But I think typically the way this would be handled in a primary care office would be a more general screening for any kind of liver disease and then some more specific investigation to see what exactly the cause was. That would include, the latter would include hepatitis C as part of a differential.
May I
yes.
ask? Okay, I guess I don't understand why that's... Are you telling me that some general practitioners or primary care physicians automatically test for the whole range, or does it have to be related to a suspicion or something that they see in order for them to test for hepatitis C? Is that the way they do it?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Morissette, I think typically you would have a general screening test for any kind of liver disease that would be given, and then if that were to be positive, then some more specific testing looking specifically for hepatitis C.
Well, actually, and it'd have to be active to show up at that point. So if it's dormant, you're not going to see it. I'd be interested in if you have any information as to how Texas got the price down for the testing. I'd be interested in seeing that.
They actually bought the equipment. They put in a bill into place similar to the one that we tried to get passed several years ago. And once they saw the effectiveness of testing, they actually bought the equipment so that the testing was done in their labs instead of having to send it to an outside lab, but I can certainly have the epidemiologist from that state get you the information. They'd be happy to.
That might be helpful, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Are there any federal grants or NIH coming up with research or money to help with this problem? It's not an Oregonian problem. It's nationwide.
Madam Chair, you're totally correct. We do have a bill in front of the Senate and the House right now. It's going to be reintroduced this year by Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison in the Senate, and it does address sending money directly to the states to help with hepatitis C, and it'll first and foremost go to states that have plans in place, which was why it was so important for the state of Oregon to get this plan in place, but we've been working very hard on that. Senator Dr. Shindo's position is actually paid for by the CDC. It is the only federal funding right now that is directly going to hepatitis C and to states. They pay for her salary. However, they do not give her any funds to perform her job, and she's done an outstanding job given that she has no money to do her job. She gets her salary paid for, and she's been a great asset to the state of Oregon. But that's about it right now. Unfortunately, the Division of Viral Hepatitis took a $2 million cut last year in hepatitis, and they're expecting another $2 million cut again this year. So unfortunately, the Division of Viral Hepatitis is getting cut, but we do have a bill in the Senate and the House to try to get money directly to the states for hepatitis C for testing and education.
Great. Do you see anything that would help this endeavor coming from us?
Respectfully, yes. Awareness is the biggest key. Given that 3/4 of the people are not aware that they have this infection, if it is understood about how important it is to get tested and just getting the awareness and the risk factors out there for people to understand that, it would absolutely make a huge difference for the people that are infected by this disease. We've asked the governor to do a proclamation for National Hepatitis Month. If you could all, May. And if you could join him in that, it would absolutely make a huge difference. Many times the health departments just need to know that it's important to you for them to start thinking about hepatitis C so they can start working collaboratively within the existing infrastructure to make a change.
Any other discussion?
I'm not trying to just say this will be the fourth session in a row. We've talked about it, so obviously there's some interest legislatively in it.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, some of us get weary of just talking about it.
Any other testimony on this? Thank you so very much. And I am hopeful that maybe at least from the federal government, we will be able to get something to the states to help this. Anyway, we'll certainly work on supporting the proclamation and try to support you in any way that we can.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the informational meeting and on hepatitis C, and we are in recess until we get Senator Westland in here, who's going to talk to us on Senate Bill 400. We're in recess. back to order, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 400 and call Senator Westland to the stand.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I think we lost our audience.
Oh, we lost?
Yeah.
We are now open in a subcommittee. All right, go for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Ben Westland, Senate District 27 from Central Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 400 today. I'd like to discuss just a little bit in broad detail what this bill does and what it requires. And that is, it requires an individual, key phrase, not aggregated numbers from a hospital system, individual hospitals to collect and publish quarterly infection rates acquired by patients while at the hospital not related to the condition of their admission. It specifically requests that DHS establish an advisory committee to help the department develop the methodology for collecting, analyzing, and reporting the data. The legislation specifically cites surgical site infections as a necessary and required infection reporting condition, bloodstream infections, and urinary tract infections, but also allows the commission to establish other specific infection conditions as the need arises. It calls for the department to annually publish its findings to interested parties, including providers, insurance companies, HMOs, commercial and patient advocacy groups. I'd like to talk just a little bit about the problem. I think everyone will agree that infections acquired in hospital settings are a significant and growing problem. As we know, the IOM reported that approximately 44,000 to 98,000 deaths occur per year as a result of hospital acquired. Please come in so we can actually have a quorum, and these words will mean something.
I will now open a full committee of the Senate Health Policy Committee.
Madam Chair, who is this guy?
Again, for the record, seeing as how we are now officially in operation, I am Senator Ben Westland to you. Senate District 27.
Madam Chair, would that be the Ben Westland from Tumalaw?
One and the same.
Okay, thank you.
As I was saying, this is a significant problem. It is getting worse. I think everyone recognizes that, and that infection-required deaths are someplace in the range of 45,000 to 98,000 deaths a year. If you extrapolate that for Oregon, approximately 1% of the population, that means we're looking at someplace between 4,000 and 8,000 deaths a year in Oregon. I would like to further say that before you, you have a specific bill, and I think the main purpose of this bill is to help the medical community in Oregon come together, collaborate, find a consensus, and help solve this problem that is growing ever more pervasive in our medical community. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Westland, last session we created a Patient Safety Commission. Isn't this kind of in their purview of things to be looking at? And have you had a conversation with them as to, I mean, because that whole thing was set up to shield folks from unnecessary litigation, among other things, and try to look at systemic problems in systems to try to eliminate risk. So has there been any conversations with those folks about this at this point in time?
I have not had any conversation with those good folks, and I appreciate your good work on that. I think one of the significant differences is the mandatory and public reporting of the conditions found by the commission as established by the methodology they require. I have one other comment that may be related to your line of questioning. I don't want to say it's a concern. There may be a substantial role for Hooper to play within this.
We have talked with the Safety Commission. They weren't ready for a report. They may be called in maybe later to give a report on what they have been doing.
He violated the principle of acronyms that people at home don't understand. IMO, and what was that last one?
Hooper. Oregon Public Health Research. Okay. I would fully comply with the rules of the committee had I been given a list of those rules or explained verbally.
We don't even have a pig.
Senator Courtney, do you have something to say?
I'm sorry, we took a recess and you're very prompt. Did you have written testimony of your remarks, Senator?
I do.
Did you?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Are they here?
Yes, they are.
Well, how come I don't have my
Because
copy?
I have one copy. You ask if I had them, and are they here? And they certainly are.
Do you know we tell all witnesses to bring sufficient copies to the committee and the committee administrator? Are you aware of that?
Well, I was just... I would say chiding, but perhaps reminding the committee chair that apparently I violated several committee rules here this afternoon, which I can assure you will not happen again.
No, we won't have him back, and that'll take care of that. So.
Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions for the good Senator Westland?
While he's on the subject, Senator Westland, do you mean Ways and Means doesn't have rules in their committees? They just kind of go freewheeling? Is that pretty much it?
Not anymore. I used to.
Well, I'm very familiar with those rules. Thank you, Mr. President. And I adhere to them rigorously. But obviously, having violated some mores of this committee, I offer my profound apologies. But more significantly, and even more sincerely, I meant very much what I said when I see this as a beginning step in a discussion to help collaboratively and cooperatively with the healthcare industry, healthcare providers, find a better way for Oregonians.
Madam Chair, on a serious note, Senator Westland, assuming that in the next month or two we're going to get something from the Patient Safety Commission, that might be the time to kind of figure out how we're going to collaborate and put together one of our famous work groups to look at this issue.
Yeah, I think a work group approach would be exceptional, Senator Cruz. Mm-hmm. I also noticed, Mr. President, that I violated another rule in that I have moved the microphone.
Now, the other, you're supposed to address the chair before you switch from one
Senator.
Side.
Senator needs to address the chair before he.
Senator Morissette.
Are you responsible for the many, many emails I have been getting from my constituents about this issue, figuring out the disease that people pick up in hospitals or the very. Is that part of your strategy to promote this, is that you get people to flood their representatives?
Well, I'm responsible for the ones that are supportive, Senator.
Oh, that's what I mean. There must have been about 150 on my email.
To answer your question, no, I am not.
Rick Bacobian, you said that a group is advocating...
Yes, Chair. Consumers Union, which publishes Consumers Report, has a website promoting mandatory reporting, and I believe on their website they have a place that you can insert the name of a lawmaker and write them.
Thank you, Senator Westland.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Paul Cizak to the stand. Notice how well prepared he is.
Yes. Oh, he had something to hand out.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Paul Cizak. I manage the Communicable Disease Program for the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 400. Let me start off by saying that I think that hospital infections are a real problem, a significant problem. And so I have a lot of ambivalence about appearing before you today to testify in opposition to it. But there are some problems with this bill that I've highlighted in my written testimony, in which I'll just briefly summarize here. Number one, of course, is that it's going to cost money that doesn't appear in the governor's budget, and so we oppose the bill on that grounds. But I think the second big concern that I have is that the bill calls for public reporting of a variety of infections from healthcare facilities that I estimate to number about 330 in the state of Oregon on a quarterly basis, basically to invite public comparisons of infection rates among institutions. And institutions vary widely in their patient mixes and the types of procedures that they do, such that any comparison is likely to be problematic. The bill asks that we do risk adjustment to try to account for some of these differences in institutions and patient mix, but the methods for those risk adjustments are not defined. To my knowledge, have not been worked out anywhere in the United States, and when the bill was proposed and it was assigned to me, I spent some time looking for, has anybody figured out how to do this? Has the CDC figured out how to do this? Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Have other states who have already passed this legislation figured out how to do this? And near as I can tell, they haven't. And as an epidemiologist, I think the methods are likely to be very complex and to require a lot of effort on the part of the individual institutions. So for this reason, it's difficult for me to support the bill as well. And I would submit to you that it might be a better idea, given that the Consumers Union has been pretty effective at getting this type of legislation submitted in many states. There is a national discussion ongoing. There's going to be a national meeting starting it's today or tomorrow, to discuss it. And it might be most prudent for us in Oregon to wait until the sort of standards for doing this risk adjustment have been worked out by others before we start sinking money into it.
Questions? Thank you, Dr. Seedlack. I would like to now call Ann Eads. Bruce Bishop.
Well, Madam Chairman, my name is Ann Eads. I am an infection control practitioner. I have been in healthcare industry for about 30 years. And most of that time practicing infection control. I'm here today to represent the Association of Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology. They are a national organization that works in hospitals and other areas of epidemiology to prevent and control hospital infections. I am currently the president-elect and have been past president a couple times. I thought it might be helpful to you and the committee to know a little bit about the kind of work that infection control people do. Most hospitals have infection control people. That is their job description. That is what they do all day. We begin our day usually by reviewing all the admissions to the hospital, looking for any infections that might require isolation. We isolate so that infections are not spread from one patient to another, from one room to another, or via healthcare workers' hands. We also monitor isolations that exist to be sure that the proper techniques and so on are being done. We go around the hospital and check for practices and procedures to be sure that everyone's washing their hands and wearing the proper gowns and doing the right kinds of things. We also work on committees forming policies and procedures to guarantee that healthcare is going on properly, such as disinfection, sterilization of all the instruments and that. And then about half of our time concerns the surveillance of infections. And most of this time, this requires a lot of chart review where you go through medical charts. You may need to talk to healthcare people and create a worksheet that describes an infection. And then according to the CDC definitions of infections. We determine whether or not it's hospital acquired or not. And then we trend those infections. We look for trends and then try to take action on any trends that we see, for example, surgical site infections or ventilator-associated pneumonias or anything like that. We make recommendations to physicians, to nursing committees. We work from the bottom all the way to the top, housekeeping to administrators and all kinds of healthcare people. We strive to uphold regulations, and there are a lot of them. There are local ones, and there are national regulations. Plus, all hospitals undergo accreditation, and they also have standards that we must follow that have to do with sort of the structure of the work that we do in infection control and all other aspects of healthcare. And on top of that, we also have a community standard so that hospitals like to be doing as good a job in each and every area as all the other hospitals in both the local community but also nationally. And that's a big part of what APIC does.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It says here there are currently no national standards for collecting and comparing hospital infection rates. Could you comment on that?
The Centers for Disease Control has the National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance Program, but out of the 5,000 hospitals or so in the country, only about 300 are actually allowed to be members, and it tends to be the larger hospitals, and you agree to collect data the way that CDC defines it. Most hospitals will go by that program, but they may not be a member, so they may not report to the Centers for Disease Control. Their data may not be part of that larger data that they publish.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a desirable goal to reach, though, that all the hospitals have some uniform system of gathering and reporting data?
The Centers for Disease Control collect the data and then aggregate it to make recommendations. They don't collect the data to report on individual hospitals. And Dr. Cieslak mentioned earlier about the differences between hospitals. And it's not just the hospital, it's not just the healthcare workers, but it's the kind of work they do, whether like they're a burn unit or trauma center or a small community hospital. There are a lot of variations. What APIC really feels is that the standardization is very important, and I think that's what you're trying to get to, Senator Morissette. I almost said doctor. is the standardization of definitions, and we are in favor of standardizing definitions and trending so that we can make more comparisons.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions, Madam Chair or committee?
Another question.
Not too hard, though.
No. I was really interested in this. Well, I'm still interested in it. And I'm trying to remember the name of the physician from OHSU who appeared before the Portland City Club and made a presentation and talked about the systemic cause of medical errors. Now, maybe we're talking about two different things. You're talking about infectious disease, and I'm talking about medical errors. But isn't, would you say it is a systemic problem that within the facilities there is not a check and balance for doing things that people, maybe we are talking about two different things, but could you respond to what you think I'm saying?
I think that the infection problem that our country and the rest of the world is experiencing is part of a global problem of emerging drug resistance, emerging complexity of healthcare, and an emerging older population that is higher risk. I think I could probably argue with the senator from Central Oregon about whether infection rates actually are increasing. When I started in the early 70s, infection rates were much higher overall. Infection rates have really dropped a lot in almost all areas, mm-hmm. except perhaps in the ICU where these conditions of population and service are really brought to bear.
Well, thank you for that analysis.
Senator Courtney.
Yes, Chair Lawrence Henderson. I wish I'd asked this question to the person who testified before you did. The one thing I don't quite understand here, I'm looking at the last paragraph of the doctor's comments. I would note in closing the topic of risk adjustment is being discussed in other states that have already adopted legislation like this, as well as the national level. And it might be prudent for Oregon to wait until the methods of risk adjustments have been tested by others. Hold that thought. And then you go to the bill, and I wish the good senator was here. On lines 10 through 35, page 2, the Department of Human Services shall appoint an advisory committee to assist the department. It goes on there of all the things they want to look into. Now, I've looked at your background here, AMT, MPH, CC, I mean, you're certified smart. You know what you're doing.
I'm going to tell my mom you said that.
I mean, you really, you know what you're doing. The good doctor knows what he's doing. You know, Oregon, I used to say, I don't say it anymore, I used to say Oregon would like to either be first or only, the first state to do something, the only state not to do something.
I'm a native.
You know, okay, so you understand what I'm saying. I guess what I'm struggling at is the fact that apparently some other states run something up the flagpole, and I mean, you're very good at what you do. The doctor's he knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't we come in maybe with amendments or something? Because it says there shall be an advisory committee, and I just quickly went through it, so I don't know all the areas, but they're there. Why wouldn't we use that approach to try to move in this area, recognizing what everybody has said up to now, Chair, and you're the nurse, you know this better than anybody, that we do have some infections going on. I'm a recipient one. I had a surgery, and I got one of these. And I'm not complaining. That happens in life. Thank gosh they had the ability to do the surgery to save my eyesight. But I guess I just don't quite understand why that doesn't play a little bit in this. Be critical of the bill, but maybe amend the bill in a way that allows us to use your expertise to see. But I don't know. I just I'm lost, and if it's not a fair question, I will withdraw it. But
I think it's a valid question. I also think that we have to remember that we do have our safety commission, too, that was sort of told to take care of some of these issues. And so let's see what their report says.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to have Mel Colon come up, please.
I want to pull everybody out of it.
And I guess my question is, how does this relate to the health department? And if so, what are you doing about it? This is a public health issue. Let me rephrase that. Is this a public health issue, or is it simply a hospital issue, or is it a public health issue?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Morissette, I guess the best response I can give you kind of harkens back to your earlier question when you asked about whether this is a systemic issue or not.
Okay.
Whether there ought to be systems in place, just like we have in the aviation industry, to prevent planes from crashing and going down, we need to take some of those same approaches and put them in place in our healthcare industry. Now, it's very easy for me to say that. It's much more complicated and expensive to go ahead and do that. But I think that kind of systemic analysis, if you will, is what the Patient Safety Commission is focusing on around all of these medical errors, including the healthcare-associated infections. So to my thinking, you know, that's a very appropriate public health way to approach this. And
a follow-up, please.
Sure.
What is the responsibility of the public health department to see that the public health is protected in hospitals?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Morissette, we work throughout the state, including in hospitals. However, it's also true that within individual hospitals, the infection control practitioners, as you have here, are largely the focus point for a lot of that activity. We work very closely with them, not only around things that occur in hospitals, but of course about things that occur outside of the hospital as well.
Follow up.
Yes.
Do you have an oversight responsibility?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Morissette, we are responsible for doing everything we can to protect the public's health, and in that sense, we do have an oversight responsibility. In addition, there are some specific statutory responsibilities around hospital licensure and so forth that the health department does do.
Follow. Well, no, what I'm trying to get at is at what point do you step in and say, okay, we have a problem, you have a licensure problem, you've got to solve this, you've got to figure out a way of solving it. I know it's an expensive thing to solve, but the buck stops with you, right?
Chair Senator Morissette, absolutely, and I would say that my experience has been when we do have an outbreak of something, you described how you look at all of the data that you collect for your institution to see if there's, for example, a cluster of infections that's occurring in an ICU, for example. My experience working with hospitals has been that they are very, very cooperative and work very hard to try to deal with those problems. And they often call us to get technical assistance and information on, gosh, how can we control this? What can we do to better investigate this and so forth? So typically the way the system works on the ground is that the hospitals do their own in-house infection control work, and we support them as best we can and, you know, as needed.
Okay. May I, please?
Yeah,
you've danced around the punitive, the hammer that you might have. Now, if we have an outbreak of infectious disease, obviously the public health department steps in and will take charge. You have the statutory authority to make sure that things go well with hospitals, and you could order a hospital to do something if you had to, right? And the punitive, you do have that in your arsenal.
Chair and Senator Morissette, we do have quite a bit of statutory authority around hospitals and what happens in hospitals. I can tell you that, in order for there to be some kind of action like that, this is a little bit outside of my area. This isn't in my shop specifically within the health department, but typically there would need to be something fairly egregious going on or something that's very, very clear. Again, most of the kinds of things that we're talking about when it comes to healthcare-related infections, these are things that are going on all the time. Unfortunately, this is a kind of a chronic problem rather than an acute outbreak sort of situation, and so that makes it a little more difficult to handle.
Senator Mercer, it's Paul Cizek is the one that actually testified on this, and is it his shop?
Madam Chair, no. It's actually the Office of Public Health Systems that does the regulatory work around hospitals. I'd be happy to get some more information on that if you'd like.
May I just... I guess what I'm getting at is that you have the authority to order something to be done if you felt it was necessary, is what I'm getting at. You do have that authority. You would have the authority to order a study done if you felt it was necessary, to put together a group to find it, to do a fact-finding. That's within the purview of your department.
Senator Moore said, I believe
that.
Yeah,
okay, that's what I was getting at. So that's good. Thank you very much. You know, and that's what I was trying to find out is just, I guess I knew that you had that authority, there seems to be reluctance to be out front and saying this is something that we're doing. You're willing, you're allowing that to happen, and you're kind of looking at it, but you could make sure it happened if you felt it was necessary.
We could tell them that it's necessary.
Well, I guess what... Excuse me, Matt. We had a discussion once before whether or not the chief medical officer of the state of Oregon should have the authority to call an emergency if we had a flu epidemic, and I guess we didn't resolve that issue. The governor has the authority. The governor can step in. We were talking about the chief medical officer of the health department being able to step in and saying, this is an emergency, do it. What authority does the chief medical officer of the Department of Public Health have in this sense, in what we're talking about right now?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I'm not sure I can fully answer that question for you. I think there are a number of broad powers. Certainly there are police powers that the state public health officer has, and there are a number of other kinds of legal measures and sanctions and so forth that could be put in place.
I think that we can continue this when we have the safety commission come up.
I just have to say just one more thing. I'm not picking on you at all, because I think what you're doing is the right thing to do, and I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay, go ahead, Bruce Bishop, or do you have some more words to say?
Madam Chair, Committee, and Senator Courtney, I really didn't get a chance to kind of address your comment, but the meeting that Dr. Cieslak mentioned is going on today and tomorrow in Atlanta. It's a consensus conference to look at ways to risk adjust definitions, how things could be done. So we're all actually kind of waiting in excitement, bated breath, to see what these are all national experts who will come together. And when you look at a problem that's big and that's national and global, you want your very best people. Certainly Oregon has some. Thank you. But there's some good people nationally, too, that we look to for guidance.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, mostly to present Ms. Eve's testimony and expertise for your consideration, and to underscore that there are national efforts going on now to address this issue, that there are local efforts going on every day in Oregon hospitals to make sure that hospitals are as safe a place for people to get well as possible. And that you did pioneering work last session in the Oregon Patient Safety Commission to look at these kinds of issues in a broad context. The Patient Safety Commission will be able to report to you about how infections fit into the overall system of care that we have and how it can be improved.
Thank you. Any questions? Jim Carlson from the Oregon Healthcare Association.
Good afternoon. For the record, Jim Carlson, Executive Director of the Oregon Healthcare Association. While most of the discussion and testimony has focused on hospital settings, the definition of healthcare facility in the bill does include nursing facilities as well under ORS 442.015. And nursing facilities is part of some federal requirements that have been in place since 1995 called the minimum data set. Already do report information on all diagnoses for nursing facility patients as part of comprehensive assessments that are done. The minimum data set, which is called MDS for short, so I don't want to get dung by the committee for an acronym, essentially within 14 days of admission of all nursing facility patients, an assessment must be done by an RN, and then that assessment is updated quarterly or whenever a significant change occurs in the condition of the patient. And included in that information is actually more detailed information on any diagnosis. So any infection that is diagnosed, the ICD-9 codes are reported as part of that. That data is transmitted to DHS, already to senior and people with disabilities, monthly by nursing facilities, and is then transmitted to CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, nationally. And so this would actually duplicate data that's already being collected and transmitted, much more comprehensive data than just looking at infections alone, which is available. As a matter of fact, you can go on the Internet and actually take a look look. If you wanted to look at urinary tract infection and the incidence at an individual nursing facility, any nursing facility in the country, you can compare it at that facility, the incidence, along with a statewide average as well as a national average. It's not risk adjusted, and I'd leave to some of the individuals in the room more knowledgeable than I am on the proper ways to risk adjust. But this would actually duplicate information that's already transmitted to DHS on nursing facility patients. And so at a minimum, if the legislation does advance, we would probably be interested in clarifying that in the legislation, either under the definition or directing the health division, for example, to get the data from SPD, as opposed to making the facility report the same data to two different state agencies within the same department.
It's interesting that the long-term care facilities have it's a database. Why the hospitals couldn't do the same thing.
Yeah, Madam Chair, nursing facilities are regulated under some very comprehensive federal statutes, and extremely comprehensive federal statutes. And this all basically came out of initially the 87, what were called the OBRA reforms, and this was basically implemented. The MDS minimum data set requirements were implemented nationwide in 1995 initially. And so this has been something that's been information. These assessments have had to be completed and reported since that time. It, by the way, I might add, was an unfunded federal mandate on the providers at the time. They've had to absorb the costs associated with nursing hours and others, to do the assessments and to transmit the data.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any questions? Any more discussion?
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, I just might say, once again, if you're comparing hospitals and nursing facilities, it's apples and oranges. They have a more static population, and I mean, it's just a whole different universe. And so the data collection, although comprehensive and expensive, might not be done in the same way. And while I see absolute merit in this bill, we did the Patient Safety Act to deal with these issues, and I think we need to let that act. That was 2 years ago. The commission is still getting their feet under them, and we'll have a report. And so we were a pioneer, Mr. President, when we passed that act. And it's going to give us a more comprehensive look than just infections. So I'm looking forward to the report of that commission. And that would be the avenue I would prefer to see us take in dealing with these issues is the commission we created 2 years ago.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
And Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I would agree in terms of we strongly supported the creation of the Patient Safety Commission and its work, and believe it would be an appropriate forum to take up this issue.
Are you a member?
Madam Chair, we do have a licensed nursing facility administrator who is a member, and then the association has actually financially supported the work of the commission as well.
Thank you. No further discussion?
Thank you.
Meeting's adjourned.